they've been living in the wilds of Wales in a cave. Say that 10 times fast. The wilds of Wales, the wilds of Wales, the wilds of Wales.
The wilds of Wales. Oh my gosh, I cannot do it twice. The wilds of Wales. Okay. And I'm Riley.
And welcome to The Cast Party.
The podcast where we read a play and talk about it.
We've got some good food.
Some good friends.
And more than enough wine to go around.
Come on in.
Oh my gosh, Riley.
What?
I have an update about my bread.
Oh my gosh, please tell me.
Okay.
What happened?
So
it sounds like it's going to be bad.
So apparently, like, okay, now this is something that makes sense if you think about it, but I didn't think about it. Apparently, you're not supposed to knead gluten-free bread. I didn't know this because I've never made it. And I don't know why I didn't figure it out, but.
So what happened?
So I kneaded it and it just wasn't rising and it wasn't rising. And I was like, well, what's wrong? And then I looked up a little more. Dug a little bit and was like, shit. So I added more flour and more of my sourdough culture and some more water, and I got it to rise, and it doubled overnight. So that's fine. Got it onto a tray the next morning, baked it. We're coming up on an hour of it being in the oven and it's not browning on top. And I was like, well, I have to take it out or it will literally just be awful. And I took it out and it's like a giant brick of bread.
Oh, I'm so sorry. But oh, that's so sad.
You know, for a first loaf, like it looked like bread. It was just like the bottom was really nice color and like nice golden brown. But like you picked it up and I was like, I could do weight training with this bread. It was bad.
Well, so, send some my way because I've been trying to find ways to work out during quarantine. So give me some of that bread and
I'll bake you some bread and you can either build a wall or do some
lifting.
Do some free weight lifting.
The bread.
So. But it's okay. I recovered my culture and I'm going to try another loaf probably after we finish recording tonight. So.
Well, let me know how it goes.
Yeah, thank you. I will.
So I started rereading Harry Potter like a year ago. And once all of this started happening, I like kind of stopped reading it. Yes, it's taken me a whole year to read it, but like I'm in college and I just studied abroad and like I wasn't going to read when I was studying abroad. So, but I finally started reading the seventh book again. And oh my gosh, I forgot how good it is.
Yeah.
Like, Harry Potter is my favorite series for a reason. And, Kearney, I don't want to finish it because then I'll be sad because my reread will be over.
Yeah. Well, you can always start again.
I know I can.
Keep rereading it.
Guys, please read Harry Potter if you have never
it's
read
so
it.
It's so good. It's so good.
The
seventh book is just perfect.
It's so like heavy too though. Like I forgot how like intense it gets.
Because
like
a
the
lot.
First three books are like, oh my gosh, it's so cute and they're doing magic and like, oh, I just want to go live at Hogwarts. And then it's like, wait, like everything's going to shit, but this is amazing and it's like the best thing that is ever written. And so that's what I've been doing is reading Harry Potter.
Harry Potter.
Harry Potter.
You're a wizard, Harry.
Hagrid
You're
is one
a
of
wizard,
the best
Harry.
Characters.
Hagrid's so good.
I love him.
And I think they don't give Hagrid enough in the movies ever.
I agree.
Like, there's so much more of Hagrid in the books.
Well, and also Lupin. I forgot because I have not read these books since elementary school. like, I have seen the movies so many times, and I'm such a big fan, but this is only my second time rereading the entire series, and I totally forgot about how much Lupin is in the seventh book. Like, he's such a big part of it, and he's barely in the seventh movie at all. Like, I know, once you, like, start reading the books, it kind of ruins the movies for you.
Yeah. But like, they're still, good movies.
They're just like they're good on their own. Yeah. You know? Like, I've been trying to get my siblings to read Harry Potter for the longest time because it's my favorite story ever. And they just can't do it. Like, they're just, they're too young. Kids these days don't read anymore. Like, we were like the last generation to grow up reading books.
Yeah.
And I have a sister who's in middle school and she just can't read because she has a cell phone to keep her busy. And I'm like, Emily, like, read Harry Potter. It's so good. She's like, I don't want to. So I've kind of given up and I've just been like, you know what? Just watch the movies. Like, you just need to experience the story. Yeah. And like, I want them to do it sooner rather than later. So if you can't read the books,
watch the movies.
The movies are okay, but
yeah.
No, yeah, the movies are great. So,
well, that's how I feel about Lord of the Rings.
Oh yeah.
Like, with people, I'm like, you should read it. It's so good. And they're like, oh, but it's so long. And I'm like, okay, but it's so good. Mm-hmm. And like, the movies are really good.
Yeah.
And they
I personally like the movies better.
That's it. This podcast is over. We're done. We're never speaking again. You're like, dead to me. Goodbye.
The movies are iconic. Like, these are known as like one of the biggest cinematic masterpieces.
They changed the face of cinema, I think.
I know. Like, they were the first big fantasy movies to,
other than Star Wars, but like, and like Star Trek, but those are sci-fi.
But that's not fantasy, exactly.
Yeah. You could.
But I love the books. Like, let me say, I love the books.
I mean, the movies are, like, really, really well done. And I haven't read the books
in Lord years. Of the Rings? Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I thought you were going to say at all. I was like, why are you vouching for these books?
Why would I?
Never read them.
Why?
I've read them.
No, I read them. I've read them. I think I've read them twice. But I haven't read them in years.
See, I also read them in elementary school, and those are a lot harder to comprehend than Harry Potter.
Yeah.
So I wonder if I read them again, I also would change my mind.
You would get so much more, which is why I am trying to start rereading them, because I'm like, oh, I have so much more like just stuff in my brain. I'll be able to understand the book so much better.
Yeah.
And catch some of the nuances of the writing now more than I would have. Yeah.
Because I remember being kind of bored, or like almost like, oh, this is so much detail as a kid. Like, I was like, this is so much. This is so extra. But I think I would appreciate that stuff a lot more now.
Definitely.
As a 21-year-old versus a 12-year-old.
Big difference.
I did just rewatch those movies too, though. Like, last week. Actually, last night I watched The Hobbit with my family. Because now we're starting to watch all of those movies after we finished the first ones.
Let's not even talk about the Hobbit movies. It's just, no.
But, yeah, I mean,
just no.
Yeah, no. They're, okay, just, they're not bad. You can't say
if
they're
you
bad.
Removed them from, if you removed them from the Lord of the Rings movies and said, this is a completely different story and has nothing to do with the Hobbit book, except we took some plot points from it, then it'd be a great movie.
See, I have not read the Hobbit book. Is it that different?
It's very different. They added so much stuff. Like, Legolas is not in the frickin' book, really, at all.
What?
There's not the lady elf who falls in love with a dwarf. They added,
No. They're also really slow. Like, I was like...
Yeah, it's...
Cinematically and visually... Beautiful.
Yes.
Like, production, it has a very high production value, I will say. But definitely, I'm like, these ones don't need to be 3 hours long.
No.
Like, well, they just don't deserve that.
The Hobbit is a much, it's written.
It's more childish.
It's too, like the first couple Harry Potter books. It's written more for the for child. Children. And it's more, whereas Lord of the Rings, was also written for children, but it was written for them, like, older.
Yeah, well, actually, yes. This is becoming a podcast about Lord of the Rings now.
Yes, but it is.
For my costume design class, we, as you know, we have to do historical costume research notebooks.
Yeah.
Where we look at different time periods, and I did the 1950s for mine, and we had to find some books that were really influential and big during that time period. And the Fellowship of the Ring came out in the 1950s.
Yep.
And I actually talked about this in my presentation, but you know, the 1950s were a time where we were coming out of World War II, which was one of the most destructive moments in time within the past few centuries. Everyone was going through a lot of pain and suffering and coming out of that. And I think it's really interesting because the Fellowship of the Ring is about starting on this new adventure. I just think that's a really interesting connection. And I think even like in that way, even though it's written for children, it's very much like you can tell it's written to reflect that part of the time period. And
yeah,
and you know, almost like a little renaissance after World War II. So that's a fun fact for you.
I have so many things that I could add on to that about Tolkien's life.
We need to get to Shakespeare
alone, but like this is not a podcast about Tolkien. This is a podcast about it's a podcast about this specific play that Shakespeare wrote.
Yeah. So sorry guys. Sorry Shakespeare.
Sorry.
We're coming back to you now.
Okay.
Act 4, Scene 1, Wales near the cave of Belarius. Enter Clotten.
I am near to the place where they should meet, if Bassanio have mapped it truly. How fit his garments serve me. Why should his mistress, who is made by him that made the tailor, not be fit too? The rather, saving reference of the word, for it is said a woman's fitness comes by fits. Therein I must play the workman. I dare speak it to myself, for it is not vain glory for a man in his glass to confer in his own chamber. I mean, the lines of my body are well drawn as his, no less young, more strong, not beneath him in fortunes, beyond him in the advantage of the time, above him in birth, alike conversant in general services, and more remarkable in single oppositions. Yet this imperseverant thing loves him in my despite. What mortality is? Posthumous, thy head, which now is growing upon thy shoulders, shall within this hour be off, thy mistress enforced, thy garments cut to pieces before thy face, and all this done, spurn her home to her father. You may haply be a little angry for my so rough usage, but my mother, having power of his testiness, shall turn all to my commendations. My horse is tied up and safe, out sword, and to a sore purpose. Fortune, put them into my hand. This is the very description of their meeting place, and the fellow dares not deceive me.
Exit. Scene 2. Before the cave of Belarius. Enter from the cave Belarius, Guiderius, Arviragus, and Imogen.
You are not well. Remain here in the cave. We'll come to you after hunting.
Brother, stay here. Are we not brothers?
So man and man should be, but clay and clay differs in dignity, whose dust is both alike. I am very sick.
Go you to hunting. I'll abide with him.
So sick I am not, yet I am not well, but not so citizen as a wanton as to seem to die ere sick. So please you, leave me. Stick to your journal course. The breach of custom is breach of all. I am ill, but your being by me cannot amend me. Society is no comfort to one not sociable. I am not very sick, since I can reason of it. Pray you trust me here. I'll rob none but myself, and let me die stealing so poorly.
I love thee. I have spoke it. How much the quantity, the weight as much, as I do love my father.
What? How? How?
If it be sin to say so, sir, I yoke me. In my good brother's fault, I know not why. I love this youth, and I have heard you say, love's reasons without reason. The buyer at door, and a demand who is shall die, I'd say, my father, not this youth.
A noble strain, a worthiness of nature, breed of greatness. Cowards, father, cowards, and base things, sire, base. Nature hath meal and bran, contempt and grace. I'm not their father, yet who this should be, doth miracle itself, loved before me. 'Tis the ninth hour of the morn.
Brother, farewell.
I wish ye sport.
You health so please you, sir.
These are kind creatures. Gods, what lies I have heard. Our courtiers say all savage but at court. Experience, oh, thou disprovest report. The imperious seas breed monsters, for the dish poor tributary rivers are sweet fish. I am sick still, heart sick. Pisanio, I'll now taste of thy drug.
Swallow some.
I could not stir him. He said he was gentle, but unfortunate, dishonestly afflicted, but yet honest.
Thus did he answer me, yet said hereafter I might know more.
To the field! To the field! We'll leave you for this time. Go in and rest.
We'll not be long away.
Pray, be not sick, for you must be our housewife.
Well or ill, I am bound to you.
And shalt be ever.
Exit Imogen to the cave.
This youth, howe'er distressed, appears he hath good ancestors.
How angel-like he sings.
But his neat cookery, he cut our roots in characters, and sauced our broths as Juno had been sick, and he her dieter.
Nobly he yokes, a smiling with a sigh, as if the sigh was that it was for not being such a smile. The smile mocking the sigh, that it would fly from so divine a temple to commix with winds that sailors rail at.
I do note that grief and patience, rooted in him both, mingle their spurs together.
Grow patience, and let the stinking elder grief untwine his perishing root with the increasing vine.
It is great morning. Come away. Who's there?
Enter Clotten.
I cannot find those renegades. That villain hath mocked me. I am faint.
Those renegades? Means he not us? I partly know him. 'Tis Clotten, the son of the queen. I fear some ambush. I saw him not these many years, and yet I know 'tis he. We are held as outlaws. Hence!
Is but one. You and my brother search. What companies are near? Pray you away. Let me alone with him.
Exeunt Bellarius and Arviragus.
Soft! What are you that fly me thus? Some villain mountaineers? I have heard of such. What slave art thou?
A thing, a slave without a knock.
Thou art a robber, a lawbreaker, a villain. Yield thee, thief.
To who? To thee? What art thou? Have not I an arm as big as thine, a heart as big? Thy words, I grant, are bigger, for I wear not my dagger in my mouth. Say what thou art, why I should yield to thee.
Thou villain base, knowest me not by my clothes?
No, nor thy tailor, rascal. Who is thy grandfather? He made those clothes, which, as it seems, make thee.
Thou precious varlet, my tailor made them not.
Hence then, and think, the man that gave them thee, thou art some fool. I am loath to beat thee.
Thou injurious thief, hear but my name and tremble.
What's thy name?
Clotten, thou villain.
Clotten, thou double villain, be thy name. I cannot tremble at it. Were it toad or adder, spider, 'twould move me sooner.
To thy further fear, nay, to the more confusion, thou shalt know I am son to the queen.
I am sorry for it, not seeming so worthy as thy birth.
Art not afeard?
Those that I reverence, those I fear, the wise. At fools I laugh, not fear them.
Die the death. When I have slain thee with my proper hand, I'll follow those that even now fled hence. And on the gates of Ludstown set your heads. Yield, rustic mountaineer.
Exeunt fighting. Re-enter Bellarius and Arviragus.
No companies abroad?
None in the world. You did mistake him, sure.
I cannot tell. Long is it since I saw him. But time hath nothing blurred those lines of favor, which then he wore, the snatches in his voice, and burst of speaking, whereas his, I am absolute, 'twas very Clotten.
In this place we left them. I wish my brother make good time with him. You say he is so fell.
Being scarce made up, I mean, to man he had not apprehension of roaring terrors for the effect of judgment, is oft the cause of fear. But see, thy brother.
Re-enter Guiderius with Clotten's head.
This Clotten was a fool, an empty purse. It was no money it, not Hercules could have knocked out his brains, for he had none. Yet I, not doing this, the fool had borne my head as I do his.
What hast thou done?
I am perfect, what? Cut off one Clotten's head. Son to the queen, after his own report, who called me a traitor, mountaineer, and swore, With his own single hand, he'll take us in, displace our heads where, thank the gods, they grow, and set them on Lud's town.
We are all undone.
Why, worthy father, what have we to lose? But what he swore to take, our lives. The law protect not us, then why should we be tender to let an arrogant piece of flesh threat us? Play judge and executioner all himself, for we do fear the law? What company discover you abroad?
No single soul can we set eye on, but in all safe reason, he must have some attendance. Though his humor was nothing but mutation, aye, and that from one bad thing to worse, not frenzy, not absolute madness could so far have raved to bring him here alone. Although perhaps it may be heard at court that such as we, cave here, hunt here, are outlaws, and in time may make some stronger head, the which he hearing, as it is like him, might break out and swear he'll fetch us in. Yet it's not probable to come alone, either he so undertaking, or they so suffering, that on good ground we fear. If we do fear, this body hath a tail more perilous than the head.
Let ordinance come as the gods foresay it, howsoe'er, my brother hath done well.
I had no mind to hunt this day. The boy Fidel's sickness did make my way long forth.
With his own sword, which he did wave against my throat, I have taken his head from him. I'll throw it into the creek behind our rock and let it to the sea. And tell the fishes he's the queen's son, Cloten. That's all I reck.
Exit.
I fear 'twill be revenged. Would, Polydote, thou hadst not done't, though valor becomes thee well enough.
Would I had done't. So the revenge alone pursued me. Polydote, I love thee brotherly, but envy much. Thou hast robbed me of this deed. I would revenges. That possible strength might meet would seek us through and put us to our answer.
Well, 'tis done. We'll hunt no more today, nor seek for danger where there's no profit. I prithee to our rock. You and Fidel play the cooks. I'll stay till hasty Polydote return and bring him to dinner presently.
Poor sick Fidel. I'll willingly to him to gain his color. I'd let a perish of such Cloten's blood and praise myself for charity.
Exit.
O thou goddess, thou divine nature, thou thyself, thou blazonest in these two princely boys. They are as gentle as zephyrs blowing below the violet, not wagging his sweet head, and yet as rough, their royal blood enchafed as the rudest wind that by the top doth take the mountain pine and make him stoop to the vale. 'Tis wonder that an invisible instinct should frame them to royalty unlearned, honor untaught, civility not seen from other, valor that wildly grows in them but yields a crop, as if it had been sowed. Yet still it's strange what Cloten's being here to us portends, or what his death will bring us.
Re-enter Guiderius.
Where's my brother? I have sent Cloten's clot-pole down the stream, an embassy to his mother, his body's hostage for his return.
Solemn music.
My ingenious instrument. Hark, Polydore, it sounds. But what occasion hath Codwell now to give it motion? Hark.
Is he at home?
He went hence even now.
What does he mean? Since death of my mother, it did not speak before. All solemn things should answer solemn accidents. The matter? Triumphs for nothing and lamenting toys is jollity for apes and grief for boys. Is Cadwal mad?
Look, here he comes, and brings the dire occasion in his arms of what we blame him for.
Re-enter Arviragus with Imogen as dead, bearing her in his arms.
The bird is dead that we have made so much on. I'd rather have skipped from 16 years of age to 60 to have turned my leaping time into a crutch than to have seen this.
Oh, sweetest, fairest lily, my brother wears thee not the one half so well as when thou grew'st thyself.
Oh, melancholy, whoever yet could sound thy bottom, find the ooze to show what coast thy sluggish crare might easiest harbor in, thou blessed thing. Jove knows what man thou mightst have made, but I, thou died'st a most rare boy of melancholy. How found you him?
Stark, as you see, thus smiling as some fly had tickled slumber, not as death's dart being laughed at, his right cheek reposing on a cushion.
Where?
On the floor. His arms thus leagued, I thought he slept and put my clouded brogues from off my feet, whose rudeness answered my steps too loudly.
Why, he but sleeps. If he be gone, he'll make his grave a bed. With female fairies will his tomb be haunted, and worms will not come to thee.
With fairest flowers, whilst summer lasts and I live here, Fidel, I'll sweeten thy sad grave. Thou shalt not lack the flower that's like thy face, pale primrose, nor the azured harebell like thy veins, no, nor the leaf of eglantine, whom not to slander outsweetens not thy breath, the ruddock wood with charitable bill, oh, bill sore shaming those rich left heirs that let their fathers lie without monument, bring thee all this, yea, and furred moss besides when flowers are none, to winter ground thy corpse.
Prithee have done, and do not play in wench-like words with that which is so serious. Let us bury him, and not protract with admiration what is now due debt. To the grave!
Say, where shall slay him?
By good Europhile, our mother.
Be it so. And let us, Polydote, though now our voices have got the mannish crack, sing him to the ground, as once to our mother, use like note and words, save that Europhile must be Fidel.
Catwall, I cannot sing. I'll weep and word it with thee, for notes of sorrow out of tune are worse than priests and fanes that lie.
We'll speak it then.
Great griefs I see. Medicine, the less for Cloten, is quite forgot. He was a queen's son, boys, and though he came our enemy, remember, he was paid for that, though mean and mighty rotting. Together have won dust, yet reverence that angel of the world doth make distinction of place tween high and low. Our foe was princely, and though you took his life as being our foe, yet bury him as a prince.
Pray you, fetch him hither. Thersites' body is as good as Ajax when neither are alive.
If you'll go fetch him, we'll say our song the whilst. Brother, begin.
Exit Bellarius.
Nay, Cadwell, we must lay his head to the east. My father hath a reason for't.
'Tis true.
Come on, then, and remove him.
So begin.
Song.
Fear no more the heat of the sun, nor the furious winter's rages. Thou thy worldly task hast done. Home art gone, and taken thy wages. Golden lads and girls all must, as chimney sweepers, come to dust.
Fear no more the frown o' the great. Thou art past the tyrant's stroke. Care no more to clothe and eat. To thee the reed is as the oak. The scepter, learning, physic must all follow this and come to dust.
Fear no more the lightning flash,
nor the all-dreaded thunderstone.
Fear not slander, censure rash.
Thou hast finished joy and moan.
All lovers young must consign to thee and come to dust. No exorciser harm thee,
nor no witchcraft charm thee.
Ghost unlaid forbear thee.
Nothing I'll come near thee.
Quiet consummation have, and renowned be thy grave.
Re-enter Bellarius with the body of Cloten.
We have done our obsequies. Come, lay him down.
Here's a few flowers, but about midnight more. The herbs that have on them cold dew of the night are strewings fittest for graves. Upon their faces you were as flowers, now withered even so. These herblets shall, which we upon you strew, come on away, apart upon our knees. The ground that gave them first has them again. Their pleasures here are past, so is their pain.
Exeunt Bellarius, Guiderius, and Arviragus.
Yes, sir, to Milford Haven. Which is the way? I thank you beyond bush. Pray, how far thither? Odds pitikins, can it be 6 miles yet? I have gone all night. Faith, I'll lie down and sleep. But soft, no bedfellow. Oh, gods and goddesses!
Seeing the body of Cloten.
These flowers are like the pleasures of the world. This bloody man, the Charont, I hope I dream, for so I thought I was a cave keeper and cook to honest creatures, but 'tis not so. 'Twas but a bolt of nothing, shot at nothing, with the brain makes of fumes, Our very eyes are sometimes like our judgments, blind. Good faith, I tremble stiff with fear. But if there be yet left in heaven a small drop of pity as a wren's eyes, fear God's a part of it. The dreams still are here still. Even when I wake, it is without me as within me, not imagined, felt. A headless man, the garments of Posthumus. I know the shape of leg. This is his hand, his foot mercurial, his martial thigh, the bronze of Hercules, but his jovial face, murder in heaven? How? 'Tis gone. Pisanio, all curses mad in Hecuba gave the Greeks, and mine to boot, be darted on thee. Thou conspired with the irregulous devil, Cloten, hast here cut off my lord. To write and read be henceforth treacherous. Damned Pisanio hath with his forged letters. Damned Pisanio, from this most bravest vessel of the world struck the main top. O Posthumus, alas, where is thy head? Where's that? I mean, where's that? Pisanio might have killed thee at the heart and left this head on. How should this be, Pisanio? 'Tis he and Cloten, malice and liquor in them, have laid this woe here. Oh, 'tis pregnant, pregnant. The drug he gave me, which he said was precious and cordial to me, have I not found it murderous to the senses? That confirms it home. This is Pisanio's deed, and Cloten's. Oh, give color to my pale cheek with thy blood, that we, the horrider, may seem to lose which chance to find us. Oh, my lord, my lord.
Falls on the body. Enter Lucius, a captain, and other officers, and a soothsayer.
To them the legions garrisoned in Gallia, after your will, have crossed the sea, attending you here at Milford Haven with your ships. They are in readiness.
But what from Rome?
The Senate hath stirred up the confiners and gentlemen of Italy, most willing spirits that promised noble service, and they come under the conduct of bold Iacomo, Siena's brother.
When expect you them?
With the next benefit of the wind.
This forwardness makes our hopes fair. Command our present numbers be mustered, bid the captains look to it. Now, sir, what have you dreamed of late this war's purpose?
Last night the very gods showed me a vision. I fast and prayed for their intelligence thus. I saw Jove's bird, the Roman eagle winged from the spongy south to this part of the west, there vanished in the sunbeams which pretends, unless my sins abuse my divination, success to the Roman host.
Dream often so and never false. Soft ho, what trunk is here without his top? The ruin speaks that sometime it was a worthy building. How, a page? Or dead, or sleeping on him? But dead, rather, for nature doth abhor to make his bed with the defunct, or sleep upon the dead. Let's see that boy's face.
He's alive, my lord.
He'll then instruct us of this body. Young one, inform us of thy fortunes, for it seems they crave to be demanded. Who is this thou makest thy bloody pillow? Or who was he that, otherwise than noble nature did, hath altered that good picture? What's thy interest in this sad wreck? How came it? Who is it? What art thou?
I am nothing, or if not, nothing to be were better. This was my master, a very valiant Briton, and a good, that here by mountaineers lies slain. Alas, there is no more such masters. I may wander from east to occident, cry out for service, try many, all good, serve truly, never find such another master.
Lack, good youth, thou movest no less with thy complaining than thy master in bleeding. Say his name, good friend.
Richard Duchamp, if I do lie and do no harm by it, though the gods hear, I hope they'll pardon it. Say you, sir?
Thy name?
Cadell, sir.
Thou must approve thyself the very same. Thy name well fits thy faith thy name. Wilt take thy chance with me? I will not say thou shalt be so well mastered, but be sure no less beloved. The Roman emperor's letters sent by consul to me should no sooner than thine own worth prefer thee. Go with me.
I'll follow, sir, but first and please the gods, I'll hide my master from the flies, as deep as these poor pickaxes can dig. And when with wild wood leaves and weeds I have stewed his grave, and on it said a century of prayers, such as I can, twice o'er, I'll weep and sigh, and leaving so his service, follow you, so please you entertain me.
Ay, good youth, and rather father thee than master thee. My friends, this boy hath taught us manly duties. Let us find out the prettiest daisied plot we can, and make him with our pikes and partisans a grave. Come, arm him. Boy, he is preferred by thee to us, and he shall be interred as soldiers can. Be cheerful, wipe thine eyes. Some falls are means the happier to arise.
Exeunt. Act 4, Scene 3. A room in Cymbeline's palace. Enter Cymbeline, Lords Pisanio, and attendants.
Again, and bring me word how 'tis with her.
Exit an attendant.
A fever with the absence of her son, a madness of which her life's in danger. Heavens, how deeply you at once do touch me. Imogen, the great part of my comfort gone, my queen upon a desperate bed, and in a time when fearful wars point at me, her son gone, so needful for this present. It strikes me past the hope of comfort, but for thee, fellow, who needs must know of her departure, and dost seem so ignorant, will enforce it from thee by a sharp torture.
Sir, my life is yours. I humbly set it at your will. But for my mistress, I nothing know where she remains, why gone, nor when she purposes return. Beseech your highness, hold me your loyal servant.
Good, my liege. The day that she was missing, he was here. A dare be bound, he's true and shall perform. I dare be bound, he's true and shall perform all parts of his subjection loyally. For Clotten, there wants no diligence in seeking him, and will no doubt be found.
The time is troublesome. We'll slip you for a season, but our jealousy does yet depend.
So please, your majesty, the Roman legions, all from Gallia drawn, are landed on your coast with a supply of Roman gentlemen by the Senate sent.
Now for the counsel of my son and queen. I am amazed with matter.
Good, my liege, your preparation can affront no less than what you hear of. Come more, four more, you're ready. The want is but to put those powers in motion that long to move.
Let's withdraw, and meet the time as it seeks us. We fear not what can come, what can from Italy annoy us, but we grieve at chances here. Away!
Exeunt all but Pisanio.
I heard no letter from my master since I wrote him Imogen was slain. 'Tis strange. Nor hear I from my mistress, who did promise to yield me often tidings. Neither know I what is betid to Clotten, but remain perplexed in all. The heavens still must work. Wherein I am false, I am honest. Not true, to be true. These present wars shall find I love my country, even to the note of the king, or all fall in them. All other doubts, by time let them be cleared. Fortune brings in some boats that are not steered.
Exit. Act 4, Scene 4, Wales, before the cave of Belarius. Enter Belarius, Guiderius, and Arviragus.
The noise is round about us.
Let us from it.
What pleasure, sir, find we in life to lock it from action and adventure?
Nay, what hope have we in hiding us? This way the Romans must, or for Britain, slay us, or receive us for barbarous and unnatural revolts during their use, and slay us after.
Sons, we'll hire to the mountains, there secure us. To the king's party there's no going. Newness of Clotten's death, we being not known, not mustered among the bands, may drive us to a render where we have lived, and so extort from that which we have done, whose answer would be death, drawn on with torture.
This is, sir, a doubt. In such a time, nothing becoming you, nor satisfying us.
It is not likely that when they hear the Roman horses neigh, behold their quartered fires, have both their eyes and ears so cloyed importantly as now, that they will waste their time upon our note, to know from whence we are.
Oh, I am known of many in the army, many years, though Clotten then but young, you see, not wore him from my remembrance. And besides, the king hath not deserved my service, nor your loves, who find in my exile the want of breeding, the certainty of this hard life. I, hopeless to have the courtesy your cradle promised, but to be still hot summer's tamings and the shrinking slaves of winter.
Then be so better to cease to be. Pray, sir, to the army. I and my brother are not known. Yourself, so out of thought, and thereto so overgrown, cannot be questioned.
By this sun that shines, I'll thither. What thing is it that I never did see man die, scarce ever looked on blood, but that of coward hares, hot goats, and venison? Never bestride a horse, save one that had a rider like myself, who ne'er wore rowel, nor iron on his heel. I am ashamed to look upon the holy sun, to have the benefit of his blessed beams remaining so long a poor unknown.
By heavens, I'll go. If you will bless me, sir, and give me leave, I'll take the better care. But if you will not, the hazard therefore do fall on me by the hands of Romans.
So say I, amen.
No reason I, since of your lives you set so slight a valuation, should reserve my cracked one to more care. Have with you, boys. If in your country wars you chance to die, that is my bed too, lads, and there I'll lie. Lead, lead. The time seems long, their blood thinks scorn, till it fly out and show them princes born.
Exhumed.
And we're back!
We're back!
We are back.
What a fun act.
Whoa. So much in there. Oh my
god. So much happened.
Loaded.
Yeah.
Also, a weird arc. Like, there's almost like nothing, like just that one monologue in the first scene. And then scene two is just huge.
Yeah.
And then little scenes for scene three and four.
Yep. It's very interesting. I guess Shakes just couldn't come up with a way to cut up all of that stuff that happened, because it like has to happen all at the same time and nobody can leave the stage. So it's one scene.
There you go. Yeah.
Yeah.
So would you like to start with scene one?
Sure. Scene one, act four, scene one. It's basically Clotin. He's been running around the forest and he can't find Imogen or Posthumus. Ruh-roh. I feel like Clotin is a Scooby-Doo character, you know?
Yes.
Like a really, like an adult version of Scooby-Doo. Clotin would be in there. But I mean, that's really...
Yeah, not much happens there.
That's not. He just rails about how upset he is. And there's He's really... Like,
where are they?
there's nothing that I particularly want to talk about in it. So.
Me neither.
It's basically the same as he had been saying in the previous act of like, I'm going to cut off Posthumus's head and I'm going to reap Imogen and then I'm going to kick her back to court and her dad won't be too mad.
He says, I'm mad.
Yeah.
That's all he's doing right now.
Yep.
I'm angry.
Yep, that's pretty much what's happening. And there's really nothing much important to talk about in that monologue to me.
He's being a little bitch.
He is.
That's all he's doing.
Clotin is a little bitch. It's true. Mm-hmm. Okay. Are you ready for scene two? We can.
I'm so ready.
Go back and forth. Okay.
Yes, I'm so excited to talk about the scene. Okay. Okay. So to recap, at the beginning of this scene, Imogen has fallen ill, and she is about to take the potion that Bassanio gave her, which she believes is medicine.
Yep.
And while she is doing this, the other characters in this scene, Guiderius, Arviragus, and Bellarius, head out to hunt. And while this is happening, Clotin shows up, dressed in Posthumus's clothing, and challenges Guiderius to a duel, in which Guiderius wins and cuts off Clotin's head.
Bum, bum, bum!
And so then Bellarius recognizes that Clotin is the dead prince from when Bellarius used to live at the court, and starts panicking. He sends his sons to go wake up Fidele, who is Imogen, only to find out that she is asleep, which looks like she is dead.
Yep.
So now they think that Imogen is dead. They are all freaking out. They take her body, bring her into the woods, and lay her down, sing a prayer over her, and then depart. After setting Clotin's headless body down right next to her.
Yeah.
Oh, this scene is crazy.
The flowers, they strew flowers on them both.
Yes. Ugh. So weird. Like,
so weird.
So weird. Like, why does Clotin need to be next to her?
Well, because they're like, but we have to bury him. Like, he's still a dead body and gotta. I really appreciate that they don't, like, dig and bury. I appreciate that Shakespeare didn't bury Imogen alive, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I just don't like why Clotin and Imogen need to have the same funeral. Like,
and it also goes back because, like, Clotin talks about it literally all the time how he wants to have Imogen, and it's kind of like Clotin's dream came true. Like, he's in bed, he's sharing the same burial bed with Imogen,
the death
but like
bed.
He's
sharing
dead.
The same death bed.
So there you go.
So gross. So let's take a moment and go over this first half because this scene is so long. But there's a lot of good juice in there, so.
So much. Well, I love that Imogen has this little tiny monologue that's, these are kind creatures, gods what lies I have heard, our courtiers say all savage but at court. And she's basically saying what this play has been saying all along, like, these people, like, I've been told how savage these Britons are, and they're just not. The real people who are savage are the ones in court, and these people are so civil and so kind and courteous.
Yeah.
So this is my favorite thing about Clotin, is this moment when Clotin says, oh, hear my name and tremble, and Guiderius is like, well, what's your name? Clotin goes, Clotin, thou villain. Guiderius goes, Clotin, thou double villain, be thy name. Now, some people think that he's just saying, oh, double villain on you, ha ha. But Shakespeare lived in a Dutch, like, neighborhood in London. And in Dutch, the word Clotin, spelled with a K, means balls or testicles.
Really?
Yes.
Oh.
And
my
so
gosh.
So
oh.
Guiderius, being well educated by Bellarius, is like, Clotin, thou double villain. Your name's Balls? What?
Oh my gosh, I'm dead.
And it is amazing. And you know Shakespeare did it on
balls.
Purpose. Yes.
He said, what's a good name for this character? Balls.
Yes. And it also, like, there's also the English word a clot. Somebody who's thick, somebody who's not smart. So that too. But also, it's a double meaning.
It all fits.
Yeah, it does.
I think this is one of the funniest parts of this play. The line after Clotin enters and he and Guiderius start bickering. Clotin says, thou villain base, know'st me not by my clothes? And Guiderius says, no, nor thy tailor, rascal. Who is thy grandfather? He made those clothes. And I just think this is so funny because Guiderius is literally saying, your grandfather made those clothes. Those are granddad's clothes you're wearing. He says, okay, boomer.
Okay, boomer.
Guiderius goes, okay, boomer. And he's literally just saying that his clothes are grandpa's clothes.
Really funny. Also, the moment where Guiderius lifts up Clotin's head, he says, this Clotin was a fool, an empty purse. There was no money in't. Not Hercules could have knocked out his brains, for he had none. He's holding up his head and he's like, there's nothing in it. It's hollow. It also, the imagery created by that moment alludes to a drawing by De Bry of a Pict with a head, which was published around about the same time because people were fascinated with the ancient Britons and the Picts were people who lived in the area. So they were fascinated with them. So it was a rendering of an ancient Pict holding a severed head and surrounded by severed heads. So it was a way to make the idea of savages alluding to the colonization of North America, like chopping off your head and stuff. And he's like, oh, but it's funny. We're making it funny now. You can all relax. So.
Yeah, I think that's so interesting. And like, so much of Shakespeare is so political.
Yeah, it's and we fascinating. Don't
think about it because it's all about the politics of London during the time that it was written.
Yeah.
But fascinating. So fascinating.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's all I got for that first half of the scene.
Me too. Moving into the second half, Imogen wakes up, sees the headless corpse of Cloten next to her, but he is still wearing Posthumus's clothes, so she assumes that it is her husband and realizes that the medicine she drank was a sleeping potion and basically blames Pisanio for Posthumus's being dead. Now she freaks out and basically starts crying over top of the body. Then at the end of the scene, the Roman army has landed. Caius Lucius and his men find Imogen and Cloten lying there, and they think they are both dead. But then Imogen rises up, says that her name is Fidele, and offers herself as a servant to the Roman commander. Caius Lucius believes her to be a young man and accepts her offer. And that is the end of this scene.
Dun, dun, dun. Dun, dun, okay, great. Dun, dun. Now let's dig it up a little bit. Great. So I have a line note. A line note?
I wonder which one it is.
It's the section, I tremble still with fear, but if there be yet left in heaven as small a drop of pity as a wren's eye feared gods a part of it. Wrens are very small. And so if there's one drop from a wren's eye of pity, please give it to me. So she's found this dead body next to her and she's like, oh, dear God. As she thinks it's a dream at first, and she's like, it's a dream, it's a dream. Everything that has just happened is a dream, so this has to be a dream too. And then she touches it and she's like, crap, it's real. It's still here. And then she asks, please make it go away, which is what if there be a drop of pity as a wren's eye is asking. Please let it go away. And then she realizes that it's real and that it's quote unquote Posthumus. And then again, at the end of this beautiful monologue, I love the line, give color to my pale cheek with thy blood, that we the horrider may seem to those which chance to find us. This act of smearing blood onto her face, because that's basically what she does. She takes Cloten's blood and puts it on her face. It was considered a Celtic practice to smear the blood of a dead loved one on your body and your face when they have been killed. And it also could allude to ancient Britons who had a custom of applying woad, which is like mud, and face paint to frighten their enemies away. So there you are.
I love this monologue so much.
It's so good.
It's gorgeous. It's gorgeous.
It's just one of the best ones out there, and not enough people do it.
I mean, this I might whole start doing it. It's yeah. So underrated. I mean, hey, you got to perform it.
I did. So it was so fun.
Totally should.
It was so good.
Keep doing it. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's why we're doing this, you know? So now everyone gets to experience cymbaling.
Yep. You're welcome.
I mean, once again, this is my first time reading this play, and I'm loving it.
It's so good.
So good. So good.
I have nothing to say about the rest of it.
I just wanted to say the soothsayer. I just love anytime there's a soothsayer in Shakespeare's plays, because it's kind of the one thing that's like more supernatural and not like really realistic.
Just wait till Act 5. So scene 3. We start out with Cymbeline. He talks about how the queen is very ill and in bed, and how her son is missing, and how Imogen is gone. And then he turns to Pisanio and blames him for everything. And Pisanio says, I have no idea where she is. I didn't know she left. I have no idea where Claudin is. Please believe me. I am your loyal subject. And Cymbeline chooses to forgive him this time. And then a lord comes in and says that Caius Lucius is here with his Roman legions, and that we have to prepare for battle, and says that they are all ready for battle and they've prepared enough and we should go ahead. And Cymbeline and him go and prepare, leaving Pisanio, who talks about how he hasn't heard anything from Posthumus. He hasn't heard anything from Imogen, both of whom promised to write him, and that he has no idea what happened to Claudin either. And he's just really confused. And then he talks about how in disobeying Posthumus's order to kill Imogen, he is doing his master and his country well and serving them well. And that's the end of scene three.
Good job.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I feel so bad for Pisanio. Yeah. Like, he just keeps getting tossed around and just tries to do the best thing. He just tries to do the best he can, and no matter what he does, he's always falling short, and he can't control it, and he just gets shat on by everyone.
Yep.
So that's my thoughts on this scene. Poor Pisanio.
Poor Pisanio. We love Pisanio. Pisanio's so good.
He's so sweet. Like, he just wants to do the right thing.
He does. And it takes him a minute to figure out what to do, but he does figure it out, which is nice. Pisanio's last monologue sets us up for stuff that's going to happen later on in the play by saying, where's Posthumus? We haven't seen Posthumus in a while. So he's reminding the audience that Posthumus still exists and that no one has any idea what's going on with him. So that we'll find out about it later. And now, shall we do scene four?
In scene four, Belarius, Guiderius, and Arviragus are back. They hear the armies moving through the woods. Belarius wants to lie low because he is scared that some of the Britons may recognize him from his days at court. But his sons are eager to fight, and they insist that they go down to assist Cymbeline's forces. And I don't have anything specific.
Well, I just want to talk about the language in this is so beautiful. And every time Guiderius and Arviragus walk on stage, like, they speak these beautiful poetic lines about everything. And they they're just so
beautiful.
Well written, and it's really beautiful.
They really are. And, you know, we talked about it a little bit earlier. How it really shows how educated they are, but just also how good, kind-hearted people they are.
Yeah.
Like, you just, like, even if you, this is also what I love about Shakespeare, is even if you go to a Shakespeare performance, like, nobody's going to understand every word that is being spoken.
No.
But, like, just the way that this is written, when you hear it, you just get the sense of these are good people. And have kind hearts, and you can get that even without having to really understand what the words mean. Like, you can just totally get that from it being read off the page.
Yes.
And that's lovely.
Yes.
It's lovely.
Yeah. And it also, like, the way that they talk reminds us always that they are highborn and well-educated, even though they've been living in the wilds of Wales in a cave. But I love Belarius's last aside. The time seems long, their blood thinks scorn, till it fly out and show them princes born. And it says that their brave and courageous hearts are outgrowing their lowly roots and how they've been raised. And they're eventually going to have to go back and be princes. Is what it says.
Oh, I'm so excited to see what happens.
I know. Act 5 is really fun.
Well, unfortunately, I'll have to wait till next week to hear what happens.
Yeah.
But that is Act 4, everyone.
Yeah. Thanks for tuning into Act 4.
Also, guys, please feel free to email us with any questions that you have or suggestions. We're always taking suggestions for new plays to read. But yeah, just send us an email at castpartypodcast@gmail.com. That's castpartypodcast@gmail.com.
Thanks for listening to The Cast Party.
The Cast Party is produced by Kearney Johnson and Riley Wilson.
Feel free to like us on Facebook and follow us on Instagram or Twitter at The Cast Party Pod.
That's all for now. See ya!